Okay, let's start. Welcome to the lecture. My name is Mikko Rönkkö and I'm one of the teacher of the research methods course. And as Arto told you last week, we'll be covering three different types of research on this course. We'll talk about quantitative research, which is my topic. We'll talk about qualitative research, which is Arto's topic. And then we'll talk about constructive research, which is Mirja's topic. So we have three lectures, three different topics. And I'm going to spend you four lectures now. And we have some. I'm going to tape all my lectures if the technique, the technology works. And it seems that we don't have any audio for the recording now. But the IT support will come here in a few minutes, and they'll try to fix that. So if you want to make notes, please do so. Otherwise, you can watch the videos, and we should have also audio in a few minutes from now. So the first thing that I want to ask you, I said that there we have three different kinds of research that is addressed in this course. We have qualitative, quantitative, and constructive. So what do you think quantitative research means? So what do we mean by when we say that we do quantitative research? Not necessarily. We can study lots of material using qualitative techniques as well. So that's not, or we can do quantitative research with just a little bit of material. So that's not the key distinction.
Using research that's observable or practical or something.
No, we can do that with qualitative research as well. What does quantity mean? We do quantitative research. We are interested in quantities instead of qualities. What do you think that means? Yeah, amounts. Basically, we do research with numbers instead of, for example, observing what people do. So we look through things by using numbers. And there are basically two things that we need to consider when we do quantitative research. One is, how do we get the numbers? How do we collect the data? And how do we measure things? How do we quantify? And the second thing that we have to consider is, what do we do with the numbers? So we get the numbers somehow, we do something with the numbers, and then we want to say some kind of research result. And these four lectures, we're going to be addressing those, how do we actually do that? Typically, when we have two or more numbers, we want to say something about the association between those two numbers. For example, we want to say that the amount of lectures that you took or that you participated is somehow associated with the grade that you will get from this course. So we want to study an association. And the basic measure of association is the correlation. How many of you know what correlation means? Raise your hand if you don't know what a correlation means. You don't know? Okay, well, that it's useful that I included this slide. I didn't have it last year. So who knows what correlation means? It's a measure of association between two quantities. For example, we could say that lecture participation correlates positively with your grade. And that would mean that as your lecture participation increases, then your expected grade will increase as well. So that's basically how we interpret correlation. So correlation is just one type of statistical association, but we deal with correlations because that is one of the simplest way of quantifying associations. So here is from Wikipedia, and we can see correlations. So we have here one variable is on the x-axis, one is on the y-axis, when x increases, y increases linearly. So x and y are completely dependent. For example, your height in inches, your height in centimeters are perfectly correlated because they're the exact same thing. Then when when the correlation decreases, we can see that there is no association whatsoever when correlation is zero. When it's negative, it means that when one variable increases, another one decreases. And correlation is the basic thing that we deal with. And oftentimes when we do more complex analysis, then the interpretation of those analyses still boils down at looking at, okay, what's the correlation? Correlation, importantly, is a measure of linear association. For example, if we have an association where when one variable increases, another one depends on the variable, but it's not linear, then there is no correlation. So correlation means that there is when one variable increases, another one goes up and up only. So it doesn't go up and then down. We have different techniques for dealing with this kind of diminishing returns and such. So we do lots of things with correlations, and oftentimes the problem is what can we actually say when we see a correlation? We'll get to that in a few slides from now. One thing that I want to get out of the way in the beginning of the class is that people think that quantitative research is more difficult than qualitative research. And I agree, but I agree with a qualification. So I like to think of quantitative and qualitative research as writing a book and doing a painting. So anyone can doodle something and call it a painting. So when we give a child a pen and a paper, they will do some kind of drawing. But when we give a child a task to write something, they can't do it. So you have to do the basic. You have to have a basic level of understanding what you're doing before you can actually analyze quantitative data. So you have to be able to write before you can be a world-class novelist. But then, just the fact that you can hold a pencil and produce something on a paper, or the fact that you can write, doesn't make you a world-class novelist or a world-class artist. So it's just that the basic things that you have to understand are a bit more in quantitative research than in qualitative research. But doing high-quality qualitative or quantitative research is a lot more than understanding how to do the very basics. So that's because you have to know something to get started. People have the impression that quantitative research is more difficult than qualitative. I think that the opposite is actually true, because there are certain rules that you can follow, certain procedures, and that will produce acceptable research. So there's the quantitative research side is much more like an engineering problem, and qualitative research side is much more like a creativity problem. So you have to be really creative to come up with a nice qualitative finding. In quantitative research, if you apply certain procedures that are known to work, then you will get the finding. So it's much more rule book-like following activity instead of like a creative activity. And at least for me, that's easier. During these four lectures, we'll cover four different things, and we have some materials as well. We'll start with research design and inference, and what research design and inference means, that it basically refers to when we see a correlation, what can we infer from that correlation? Because we can infer many different things. Sometimes we can see that there's a correlation, and that's just one correlation. It doesn't mean anything. Sometimes the correlation means a lot, depending on where the correlation comes from. Then measurement relates to where do we actually get those numbers that we use for calculating the correlation. For example, if we want to study information system satisfaction and system usage, how much are those two correlated? Well, satisfaction is not something that we can just go and check from the box in which the information system came from. We have to somehow get the information about satisfaction from the actual users. So how do we measure that satisfaction? Then regression analysis is the third topic. Regression analysis is the second most simple technique. So correlation is the simplest. Regression analysis is an extension from correlation where we have more than two variables. Oftentimes, regression analysis is used for testing which of, let's say, four alternative explanations for our phenomenon actually matters. And then on the fourth lecture, I will present you a practical research problem, a practical data analysis log, like how I would go about analyzing the data and to arrive to a research result. And I have also prepared a screencast where I actually do the analysis on that I present on the final class. If you want to do it yourself, then you can follow that screencast. The materials that we have for you for the quantitative part are from the book by Singleton and Straits. They talk about research design and measurement, and then they have two chapters about data analysis that I want you to read. And I recommend that if you have the time, skim through the material before the lecture, and that will allow you to connect the material and the lecture better, and therefore be better prepared for the actual exam. Then we are going to be using a paper by Venkates, published late last year, as an empirical example. So instead of just explaining you the theory behind quantitative research, we're going to be looking at one particular research paper and how the authors of that particular research paper applied the concepts that we're going to be talking at the class. So that's the readings, not too much. Let's start from the very basics. When we deal with numbers, we deal with what we call statistics. And statistic is something that we calculate from a sample, and we often want to generalize from that sample to a population. We call that statistical inference. I'm going to start with an example, and the example comes from Mikko Ketokivi's book. And this is from the 2009 edition, but there is a more recent edition as well, which includes the same example. And that's the best book written in Finnish about doing quantitative research that I'm aware of. So he explains in the beginning of his book that there was in 2005, there was this in the summer when it was a slow news cycle, many Finnish newspapers published this research result that among the 500 largest Finnish companies, those companies that were led by women, had a women CEO or the chief executive officer, had 4.7 percentage points higher return on assets than men-led companies. So there's a clear correlation. Return on assets is a measure of profitability. So if you have higher return on assets, it means that you make more money. And it's correlated with the gender of the CEO. So we have a correlation. What can we say about it? What does that correlation tell us? Can we say, yeah? Well, yeah, that's how some people interpret it. We should have more women CEOs, and that would make the Finnish largest 500 companies, or maybe all Finnish companies, to do more profits. So the headlines in the papers were women lead to profits. Naiset tekevät tulosta in Finnish. What can we actually say about that correlation? Can we say that all companies now should get women CEOs? Yeah, I see some heads turning. No, we can't. Why can't we say that? So what prevents us from saying that?
We don't know everything that's related to the
CEO. Yeah, so there are many different factors than the CEO's gender that influences companies' profitability that we don't know about. So there may be some alternative explanations. But before we go into that part, there is one important question that we should always when we see one correlation. So if I tell you that in 2005, the women-led companies were more profitable than men-led companies, what's the question that you should ask?
What about in 2006?
Yeah, what about in 2006 and 2004? Was it the same or was it different? So different companies make different profits each year. So it's not like one company is always profitable. It varies. could be that the women-led companies happen to have a good year. And it could be that the next year the women-led companies actually had bad years and they were less profitable than men-led companies. So the first thing when we see a correlation is that we have to address, could that correlation be there just by chance only? So that's the first question, and that's a question of statistical inference. Can we generalize from this correlation to other correlations, for example, other years? Can we generalize it from 500 largest Finnish companies to maybe 5,000 largest Finnish companies or all Finnish companies? The only thing that that figure tells us is that at one point of time, in one sample of firms, those led by women were more profitable than men-led companies. So we have to ask first, before we even start to consider whether there's a causal effect between CEO gender and profitability, we have to ask, does the correlation even generalize? So is it just 1 year, or is it all years, or is it just these 500 companies, or is it all 500 Finnish companies? So when we see a correlation calculated for one data set, we have to consider that that data set is a sample of some larger population that we are interested in. So we have to define, what are we actually interested in? Are we interested in those particular companies at that particular time when there's a correlation, or do we want to generalize to every time point or every company? So we have the largest 500 companies in 2005 as our sample. So what do you think could be the population? So what do we want to generalize from those 500 companies? Where could we generalize? Could we generalize to all companies in all countries in the world ever founded and ever now and that could exist in the future? Yeah, we want to say something about the companies, typically, not about the CEOs. So which companies could we generalize that correlation? Can we generalize to all companies in the world? Could we generalize to multinational corporations headquartered in China? Probably not. So probably we want to only generalize to Finnish companies, or maybe some other companies in other societies where women actually have about equal role to men. And we want to generalize over time. So let's first ask the generalization over time, because we want to say that this is something that is not just 2005, but that persists over time. We have to ask, the question is, could it be by chance only? So how do we know if a 4.7 percentage point difference is plausible to occur by chance only? What kind of questions do we need to ask? Well, first, is it a large difference? So small differences could happen by chance only. Large differences, probably not so. If you have a die and you throw it 10 times and you always get a 6, then I'm going to say that that die is not fair, because 3 sixes is a very unlikely result. So we have to ask, is it a large difference? So what do you think? Is 4.7 percentage points difference, is it a large difference? So return on assets means the amount of money invested and how much profit it brings you every year. So if I would say you that one bank gives you 4.7 percentage points more interest for your money than another bank, would you be interested in switching banks? If I say that your loan is going to be 4.7 percentage points more expensive in another bank, would you be interested in switching banks? Yeah, so it's a huge difference. Return on assets is typically about 10%. So it means that the women-led companies produce about 1.5 times as money as the men-led companies. So it's a really, really big difference. What else do we need to know? Yeah, what do you think? That's the second consideration that we have to ask. How many women there are? What do you think? Is it half? Is it 1 or 10? Any ideas? Happens to be there were 22. So 500 largest companies, 22 were led by women. So there were 488 companies led by men compared to 22 led by women. So then we have to think of a strategy. So how do we rule out chances and explanations? And one very good strategy for doing so is to just say that, okay, there is no difference. We call it the null hypothesis. There is no difference between men and women led companies. And then we ask, what kind of differences would be able to could we obtain if there really was no difference? How we actually can do it is that we can take the 500 largest Finnish companies, we can choose 22 companies at random, calculate the mean return on assets, and then calculate the mean return of assets for the remainder of the companies, and compare the results. So we take a random sample. There is no difference because it's random. So random 22 companies compare against random 488. So what kind of difference do we get? We repeat it many times, and then we can see how frequently we would get a large difference. Because it's only by chance, because there's no systematic difference if we take one set of companies randomly and compare with the rest. So we can do that with a computer, and we get one sample, we get 2.43 difference. From another sample, we get minus 0.98, 0.1, and so on. So we can see that the differences are something like that when we check the difference over 50 replications. So we take randomly 22 companies, randomly the remaining companies, compare, repeat the comparison 50 times. We can see that the difference is typically quite a bit less than the 4.7. But we also see that, well, there is one out of 50 times that we got a larger difference. So could it be by chance only? One out of 50. Yeah, probably good. There is a more formal approach to this kind of analysis. We can just do it 10,000 times, and we can see that from a random division into two groups, we have sometimes we have minus 10, sometimes we have plus 10, the difference, and most of the times the difference is around the mean. So this shows the distribution of 10,000 replications when we divide the companies randomly and compare the two groups. Then we compare the actual result, 4.7 percentage points, to this probability distribution that represent no difference at all. We can then check that, okay, the probability of getting that kind of difference would be about 3.5%. So if there was no difference between women-led companies and men-led companies, and we observed the difference over 100 years, then on average, on 3.5 years, we would have women-led companies to be more than 4.7 percentage points more profit. Okay, so could it be by chance only that we get a 4.7 percentage point difference? Is 3 out of 100, is it a large probability? It's not very large, but it's still possible that it could be. If it was 1 in a million possibility to get that kind of difference, then I would say that I'm very confident that there is something systematically different between men and women at companies. With 3%, I'm not that sure. This probability here, what would be the probability of getting that kind of difference by chance only, is called the p-value. And that is, besides correlation, that is the one of the most widely used statistics in quantitative research. Because it quantifies whether, or it tells us some way, whether a result can be attributed to chance. Of course, we get large correlations by chance only. So if every time we get a large correlation, we shouldn't always make the inference that there actually is something going on. And p-value helps us to make the call of whether the correlation is something that we should be interested or not. Typically, researchers are okay with the 5% level. So let's say that there's the 5%, 0.05 in the p-value means that we are okay with having a false positive 5% of the time. False positive means that we conclude that there is something in the population where, in fact, our result is just a random occurrence. And we call this random occurrence, we call it null hypothesis. So null hypothesis typically means no effect, no correlation, no difference between the means. So that means that there's nothing interesting going on, unless we're specifically interested in saying that there's nothing going on in the population. So that's the null hypothesis, and typically 0.05, when the p-value goes below 0.05, we say that a correlation or a difference or whatever statistic we are interested in is statistically significant. So you see this term statistically significant all through papers that you read. So I would say that nearly every paper in information systems, at least every paper worth reading, contains the term statistical significant or statistical significance somewhere. And it just refers to how confident we are that the result is not due to just chance only. The p-values are typically presented in articles, so this is from the Venkatesh paper that I'm using as an example. So one way of how you see it in an article is that there is a claim. This article is about how individuals use government information systems, and they make a claim about individuals, then they present a statistic. Beta here is a regression coefficient, which is kind of like a correlation, and then you have the p-value saying that this is unlikely to be there by chance only. We don't want to be publishing chance results, so we pepper the papers with these small p-values if they exist. Another way of where you can find these p-values in research is in tables. So oftentimes, you see papers presenting tables of figures, of numbers, and we're going to be looking at this table more later on these lectures. But for now, you can see these stars here. The stars indicate that the p-values are less than 0.05, less than 0.01, or less than 1 in 1,000. So that indicates how confident the researchers are that there's actually some kind of effect for that particular statistic. So it quantifies, can we rule out chance? Typically people interpret the p-value in a way that if the p-value is small, then there must be an effect. But that's not quite the case, because we can have chance results. Let's do an example. So on the next slide, I'm going to show you two dice. Die is not point finish. So the dice are from 1 to 6. And there are two dice. You have to guess whether what the dice are, or if any of you can see the future, then you will know that what the dice are. So this is a test for clairvoyance. Can you see the future? If you can see the future, then you will know what the two dice are. If not, then you have to guess. Guessing is our null hypothesis. So pick two numbers from 1 to 6. So 2 and 5. How many of you could foresee the dice? Yeah. So congratulations, you are clairvoyant that less than p, that's that with p is less than 0.05. So the p value tells what is the probability of getting a result by chance only. It doesn't tell you what is the probability that you're actually clairvoyant. It just tells that sometimes people get it correctly. If I would throw the die, let's say, 100 times, and you would always guess it correctly, then I would buy that you're maybe a clairvoyant. But the P is less than 0.05 is not very strong bar to pass. If we test 20 statistics, then on average we can expect that one of those will be significant at less than 5% level, because we are basically saying that the 5% is defined as the false positive rate. So the null hypothesis here is that you chose the dice randomly. Then, if you answered correctly, the probability of answering this correctly is 1 out of 36. So it's 0.028. And if you answered correctly, you are clairvoyant. You can see the future with P is less than 0.05. With this example in mind, do you think that the 4%, 4.7 percentage points difference in the previous slide with P value is less than 0.037? Is it a strong evidence that there is a difference between men and women-led companies? Is it strong evidence? Based on this die-throwing exercise, you should understand that we sometimes get p-values that are less than 0.05 by chance only. I don't for a second believe that any of you are clairvoyant. So you got it corrected by chance only. So the p-value 0.05 is not that streak of a bar. But maybe there's something. The p-value relates to two important statistical errors, and this was an exam question in the exam that was a couple of weeks ago. So we can do, in statistical inference, we can do two types of errors. We can either say that there is an effect, there is a difference between men-led companies and women-led companies, where in fact there is no difference. So we are getting a p-value that is small by chance only. And that's called type 1 statistical error. And then type 2 statistical error refers to concluding that there is no difference between men and women-led companies, where in fact there is. So we can make these two kinds of errors. Which one do you think is more serious? Concluding that there is a difference between men and women-led companies, or than concluding that there's no difference? Which one is more serious? Why? Let's have another example, type 1 and type 2 error. We have a medicine. The medicine does not work. Then we have a trial. The trial result says that the medicine works. So the trial result incorrectly says that the medicine works. What will happen? Yeah, doctors will prescribe the medicine because it has been shown to work, where in fact that was a false positive finding. And then people will take drugs that don't do any good for them. What if we have a drug that actually works, and then trial shows that it doesn't work? What will happen? Nothing. And back to doing more research, and eventually someone will find out that it actually works. So type 1 errors are a lot more serious because they typically have some kind of policy implications. You do actions based on existing evidence, and it's better to not do actions based on wrong evidence than to do actions based on wrong evidence. So type 1 errors lead to action, type 2 typically don't. So that's the type 1 is more serious. Then the p-value is commonly misinterpreted. If you pick a random five articles in the leading information system journals, you can pick the journal, and I will bet you a beer that at least one of them says that the p-value, because the p-value is less than 0.05, it means that we are 95% certain that the result is correct. That's a very common misinterpretation. The p-value typically, it tells you what would be the probability of getting a result by chance only. It doesn't tell you anything really about the probability of your result being correct. So it's kind of like we still, because it would be so convenient to interpret the p-value as if it would be the likelihood of us committing an error, that we still misinterpret it that way. The only thing that we can say based on the p-value is that if the p-value is low, then maybe there's something, but we can't make any definite statements. Okay. Then the next thing that we want to go through, let's assume that we have some way established that the difference between men and women-led companies in this sample could not have been by chance only. Let's say our p-value is 1 in a million, then I would say that I buy that there is something in the data. Can we make the claim that naming a woman as a CEO causes profitability to increase? Can we? There is no way women-led companies are more profitable than men-led companies by chance only. That has been ruled out somehow. Can we say that naming a woman as a CEO causes companies to be more profitable? Why or why not? Well, someone said that at the beginning of the lecture that there could be some other reasons. Still, the problem is that people interpret it as if the statistical significance means that there's a causal effect. And this is an example from a report by a big consulting company, McKinsey, that has studied the relationship between the gender and profitability. And they conclude that there is a statistically significant difference, and then they conclude that you can't interpret it causally. And, well, what do people who read the report then conclude? Well, there is a magazine called Fast Company that reported this result, and they said that in order to improve the company's performance, allow women to advance. So people still want to interpret that whenever you have a correlation, there's actually some kind of causal relationship. You generally cannot make that conclusion. Correlation could be interesting, but typically we want to actually make a causal claim instead of a correlation, because causal claim allows us to do policy implications. If you take this medicine, you will get better. If you do this kind of information system development practice, your productivity will increase by 10%. But we want to have these causal claims because they have policy implications. So causal inference. Let's first think, do we actually need to always have a causal interpretation for a correlation? Would it be valuable to know that women-led companies are more profitable than men-led companies if that was not a causal relationship? Let's say that we observe that every time when a woman is named as a CEO of a company, then the profitability of that company will increase. We observe that, but for reasons that we'll talk about in a few slides, we cannot yet say that naming a woman as a CEO causes the profitability to increase. Would it be valuable to know that every time as a woman is named as CEO, then company's profitability is likely to be increased? It would be valuable, for example, if you were investing in companies. Then you would know that, okay, when women is picked as a CEO, then you know that you should be investing in that company because it's going to become more profitable. Even if the act of actually naming the woman as a CEO would not be the driving force. So we have to first, when we see a correlation, think, what do we actually want to say? And there are different levels. There is, in quantitative research, the first level is description. We can say that women-led companies are more profitable this year. It could have some implications for somebody. If someone told me that our students who take the exam of this course, half of them fail, that's a descriptive finding. It doesn't really say anything causal. It doesn't really say anything about generalizability. If someone told me that, then I would know that, well, maybe there's something wrong with the teachers, something wrong with the exam, or something wrong with the students. And then I would know that I would have to look more into it. So description could be useful. Typically, we are interested in going more deeper. So the next thing is prediction. So if we know that when a woman is named as a CEO for some reason, then the company will be more profitable. That would be useful because it allows us to predict. And prediction allows us to anticipate future things. If we see, let's say that a farmer 1,000 years ago sees leaves of a tree falling down, then they will know that now it's a good time to gather my harvest because winter is coming. It's not that the leaves caused the winter to come. It's just that they happen to be correlated, and that correlation is useful for prediction. So prediction is another level. Then when most of the research that we do in information systems is not focused on prediction, we are focusing on trying to make causal arguments. One thing causes another. And we have causal inference. And naming a woman as a CEO causes the company to be more profitable. That's a useful finding. And when we go one level deeper, we have a causal explanation where we actually know what is the mechanism. Understanding the mechanism is often useful, but it's not absolutely necessary. For example, many of medicine that we actually use, one of the most commonly used medicine that they use to put people to sleep, we don't really know how it works. We have just established that when we give people the medicine, they will become unconscious. We don't know the mechanism. We would like to know, but oftentimes we have clear implications of the finding that there is a causal relationship, even if we don't really know how it works. So we have these four levels. And statistical analysis can give you description, prediction, and explanation but to the inference level, but it cannot really uncover what is the mechanism of what leads from the cause to the effect. Let's get back to the example. What do we need to show in order to show that it's actually the women that causes these companies to be more profitable? So we have a finding that women-led companies are more profitable systematically than men-led companies. We have one key question that we need to ask to make a causal claim. We have to ask, why is there a difference? Is it that the women somehow caused there to be a difference? Or is it possible that there is some kind of alternative explanation for this observed correlation or observed relationship or difference? So we need to consider alternative explanations. And those alternative explanations for why there is a relationship, we call them theories. So we need a theory. And theory refers to an explanation of what happens, when, and how, and particularly why something happens. So we have to explain the mechanism. Or at least we have to rule out alternative mechanisms. Okay. We have to answer the question, why are the return of assets between the mainland companies and women-led companies different? When you want to make a claim that women actually are, naming a woman as a CEO causes the profitability of companies to increase, then you have to step into the shoes of a skeptic. So what kind of alternative explanations the skeptic would say? What kind of alternative explanations, besides the women being the causal force, could we have in this particular example?
Women could be leading smaller companies that experience faster growth than the larger companies that are like that.
Yeah, so it could be that smaller companies are more likely to hire women as CEOs, and smaller companies are more profitable. That theory is actually, that's empirically supported in this data. Any other?
Maybe it's more difficult to become a CEO as a woman, and that's why only the best women as CEOs.
Yeah, that's one of the leading theories why women-led companies are actually more profitable. So the more women-led companies are more profitable. That has been established in many, many studies. That's one of the leading theories. Women are discriminated against, so you have to be a lot better leader to become a CEO of a major corporation if you're a woman. So therefore, the average women leader is better than average man leader. Any other? There is one very good explanation is industry. So if you have heavy industry that has you need lots of capital, lots of equipment, then your return on assets will be lower because of how it's calculated. And that kind of industries tend to be more man-focused. So if you have a design studio that really doesn't have much except the people working there, so the assets is very low, then the return on assets will be high because you divide the profitability with a smaller number than, for example, in a mining company where you need to have lots of land, lots of equipment, and then that will be used to divide the same amount of profit with a larger number. So industry differences. So we have to think about these alternative explanations always. And we could say that there's actually the women causes the top management team to work better and then therefore perform. So the women is actually the causal force, but it's not directly. So it's very unlikely that just the biological gender of a person affects the profitability of the company that they're leading. So that's improbable. We have firm size and industry are alternate explanations. Smaller companies are more likely to hire women as CEOs. Smaller companies are more profitable. Therefore, there's a correlation. We call it the spurious correlation. And that's Singleton and Straits chapter talks about this spurious correlation a lot. We have also an alternative explanation. Maybe it is that the companies that are actually more profitable are more likely to hire women CEOs. We are doing well, so we could just as well hire a woman as a CEO. Or it could be that CEO gender means that the CEO is better, and the firm performance is therefore better. That would be the discrimination argument. And we have to, when we see a correlation, we have to rule out these alternative explanations. It's the CEO gender that precedes the profit, not the other way around, and there's no third variable that explains the correlation away. So we need to, typically when we have a correlation, we need to also get some other data for these alternative explanations. Get the industry and firm size, and that's very easy to get because it's reported in the same data set that these reporters analyzed. More formally, we have three things that we have to show to claim causality from quantitative data. And We have to show that there's some kind of association. This was also, this has been an exam question a couple of times. So we have to show an association. There's a correlation between the cause and the effect, the X and the Y, the CEO gender and the profitability. Then we have to show that there's a direction of influence. So it's actually the CEO gender that causes the profitability and not the other way around. Then we have to rule out alternative explanations such as this is actually driven by industry differences or driven by company size differences. So that's elimination of rival explanations. We have a very straightforward strategy to deal with the second. So the first one was about establishing a correlation that is not due to chance only. And you do that by calculating the correlation, and then your statistical software will give you the p-value for that correlation. If the p is less than 0.05, then you conclude that there is an association. How do we, how could we analyze the direction of influence? Yeah, how do you do it? We have data about CEO genders and we have data about company profitability. So how do you check the direction? Let's say that I give you a pill now and I ask you, I give half of you a medicine for making whatever disease to go away, and I give you half a placebo, and then I ask you right away, do you feel better? Can I claim that the medicine has an effect? No, because typically effects take time. So the strategy to rule out the direction of alternative direction is to measure the cause before the effect. So let's say, who's the CEO now? And what's the profitability of the company next year? So we measure the cause before the effect. So that's basically the best strategy that we can use. So it's very simple to rule out the direction. We can't do something today and say that it causes something to happen yesterday. We can do something tomorrow and argue that it causes something to happen the day after. So the direction of influence is you basically just measure things at different times. Elimination of rival explanations. That is more challenging. We have two strategies to eliminate rival explanations. One is called experiment. So we randomize our sample, our population, into two groups. One receives the treatment, other one doesn't. Then we compare the outcome. For example, in this sample of 500 companies, we could do an experiment by taking 250 companies, picking 250 random Finnish women, then assigning those as CEOs, picking 250 random Finnish men, assigning those as CEOs to the other half, and see what are the profitability levels 2 years from now. So we could do that. It's not plausible way, but that would be one way of doing that with an experimental design. Another one is that we use statistical modeling or controlling. So instead of looking at the correlation, we build a model, a statistical model such as a regression analysis that doesn't contain just CEO gender and profitability, but also the alternative causes that we're interested in, such as companies as an industry. And then we ask the computer to figure out which of these three variables actually matter for performance. So that's a statistical modeling. Typically, in information system research, the statistical controlling is a lot more common because very few things you can actually assign people into two groups and do random, and one group does something, another group does something. It happens, but it's not as common. So the idea of an experiment is that we have a population, the people, we want to see if a medicine works for the people, and we divide people into two groups. One gets the medicine, and one doesn't. Then we compare what's the difference after. If there's a difference, then we conclude that the only reason why there's a difference between the treatment group and the control group is because one group got the medicine and another one doesn't. This works because if we assign a larger group of people randomly into two subgroups, then those two groups are statistically indistinguishable because the assignment is random. There's no differences, no systematic differences if we divide it into two. The only reason why there's a difference at the end of the experiment is because the medicine actually did something useful. And then in medical research, you have to repeat it three times before the medicine actually gets a permission to be sold. So you have to repeat it many times because there's still the possibility that we could get a false positive just by chance only. So even in experimental research, you have to think that there could be a chance difference. Okay, well, that's not a very practical way. We can't divide the companies into two and assign women's CEO to other half and men's CEO to other half. And that would be quite unethical because randomly changing CEOs probably ruin the Finnish economy. So we wouldn't have ethics board approval for that kind of design. So we have to work with control variables. And a very simple approach to control variables or statistical controlling is that we step into the shoes of the skeptic. Try to think the leading alternative plausible explanations for the difference. Company size and company industry are the two leading alternative explanations. We could do, for example, we identify that there is a relationship between gender and performance here. For some reason, the projector doesn't show the colors correctly. We have gender and performance, and they correlate as indicated by this overlap here. Now we add a control variable. We ask, okay, what if we take into account that there could be company size differences? So how much of this larger difference remain after we control for a third factor size? And that's the idea of statistical modeling. You want to answer the question, what is unique when we eliminate these rival explanations? So we take kind of like bites away from this diagram, and then how much is remaining? If something remains, then we conclude that maybe there's a causal effect. One way to think about that, or one strategy to implement that, is that, okay, let's say that we identified from the data that there are very few women that lead large companies. So a better comparison could be to compare companies that are less than 250 people, for example. So if there are no women-led companies that are more than 250 people, that's an arbitrary number, then we conclude that let's leave those out. So that, at least partially, takes away the company size explanation. So we try to get these samples that are more representative in terms of company size. And that's called matching. Then we compare the match samples. We can see that, okay, after eliminating companies with more than 250 people, we have 18.1 versus 19.5 men and women-led companies difference. So the difference is smaller when we make the company sizes more comparable. Then we would conclude still that there is maybe some effect, but after we take size into consideration, then the effect is a lot smaller. That's a practical approach only if you have one variable that you want to control for, only if we want to take account into size. If we want to take size and industry both into account, then we have to do something more complicated, which is what regression analysis does for you. So we can say that instead of saying that return on assets correlate with gender, we can say that the computer estimates or gives us a model where return on assets is a function of gender and company size, and let the computer figure out which one of those actually explains the dependent variable. So that's another way. And this kind of like you build a model, you say that return on assets depends on these things, then there is no limit on how many additional things you can add to the model. with some qualifications. These alternative things that we have to take into account, alternative explanations, are referred to as control variables in research. And control variables are used in almost every information system study. So if you take 5 studies out of any information systems journal, I can bet you a beer that at least 4 of them contain the word control variable, or we controlled for, or something like that. So they include alternative variables that could explain both the cause and the effect. So alternative control variables refer to what kind of alternative explanations we want to rule out. And in this explanation, in this example, the size and the industry would be the most leading ones. And that's an example from the Venkatesh paper. You can see how they report control variables. And typically, there is a section that says that, well, these are the leading causes. If a relevant control variable is not included, then the result will not be valid. So let's say that that we do a study about the women, the CEO gender, and profitability, and we don't control for size or industry differences. Then a skeptic comes and says, well, it could be a size difference. We can't do much about that. The skeptic could be right. So we have to anticipate what are the challenges. Once we rule out all other plausible challenges, then we can say that maybe there is a causal relationship. So the 2 strategies were experiment and then try modeling, statistical modeling of what actually explains the return on assets or the dependent variable. The experiments, the difference are, in experiment, we have to have control over the subject. So we have to be able to divide companies or people or organizations or software development teams into 2 groups. Then we do something for one group, and we don't do the same thing for other group. We wait a little, then we see what's the difference. For example, one set of development teams, we say that you have to use this new agile software development methodology, and another gets to use whatever they have used this far. Then we see what's the productivity level in half a year. That would be an experimental study. They are statistical controls. We don't have control of the units that we study. We don't have control of the companies. Or if you are a student doing your master thesis on information system implementation projects, you don't have a control over how companies that you study implement their systems. So we just have to collect the data as passive observers. And then we try to think really hard what kind of alternative explanations do we need to control for, and then we collect some data for those as well. Well, then this far, my talk about correlations has been that we have to establish that there is a correlation that could not be explained by chance only. And then we have to rule out alternative explanations. So we have to have some kind of theory that we test using the correlation. But can we just observe that there's a large correlation and then infer, based on that correlation, that there must be something going on? Just that we see a large correlation, can we say that there must be a causal effect? Quantitative research typically goes from making some kind of a hypothesis. Let's say women-led companies are more profitable because the women are better leaders, and that therefore the companies are more profitable. Then we try to think about alternative explanations. Then we collect data. So the theory comes before the data collection, and the data are used to test for the theory and possible alternative theories. Can we go the other way around? Can we identify that there's a large correlation? And then make a theory or a causal claim. Who thinks that when we see a large correlation, there must be a causal relationship? Who thinks not? Most people don't have an opinion. I guess that's why you're taking the course. There are two reasons why you can't infer that there's a causal relationship or make a theory based on a correlation. So one of the key things about the theory is that we say that one thing causes another, and then we explain why that happens. So the theory is an explanation of how, when, what, and why. And just if we observe that the women-led companies and whether the companies led by women and the profitability are correlated, the correlation in itself doesn't tell us anything about why it exists. So correlation can't answer the why question, so therefore we can't make a theory based on correlation. Another reason is that correlations could be by chance only. If you look hard enough, you will find large correlations that don't make any sense at all. There is this nice website that called Spurious Correlations, and the guy who made this website took many United States databases and correlated. Then he found that, for example, U.S. spending on science, space, and technology is correlated at 0.99, so almost perfect correlation, with suicides by hanging, strangulation, and suffocation. Well, do we say that because U.S. spends much in space exploration, that causes people to commit suicides? No, we can't. So if you look hard enough, you will find these large correlations by chance only. So correlation, we always test it after we have a theory. Theory first, then we check if the correlation supports the theory or not. The idea, this is also from Keto Kivi's book, is that we have some kind of theory. We say that women CEO gender causes profitability. Then we infer that, okay, then we should observe a positive correlation with CEO gender and return on assets, which is something that we can actually measure. So we have this theoretical statement about gender influencing profitability. It's called a proposition, and theoretical concepts or constructs are the part of the proposition. And then we form a hypothesis. If there actually is a relationship between women's CEO gender and profitability, what should we observe in the data that we are going to be collecting? And that is called a hypothesis. So we make a hypothesis based on the theory. If the hypothesis is correct, then we say that maybe the theory is correct. If we say that women's CEO gender causes companies to be more profitable, and we find no difference between men and women-led companies and return on assets, then we can confidently say that there are theory that there is a causal effect is incorrect. Then we go and we actually collect some data and we calculate the statistic, and then we see if the hypothesis is supported. This relates to inductive and deductive reasoning. The idea of inductive reasoning is that we go from a particular observation. So we go from a particular correlation and then we come up with a general theory. We can't do that with correlations because correlation doesn't tell us why it exists. It can't provide us an explanation. Instead, we do deduction. So the idea is that if our claim, our proposition about the CEO gender and profitability is true, then we should observe our hypothesis, and then we go and we actually calculate a statistic to see if the hypothesis holds. We don't do induction, and in quantitative papers, this is typically presented in the following way. So again, if you pick any information system article that uses quantitative techniques, I'll bet you a beer that 4 out of 5 contain this kind of structure. So you have some kind of explanation here. And from the Venkatesh paper, they explain why information accuracy will cause people to use government information systems more. and why inaccurate information will cause people to use the system less. They have a theory, it's explained as one paragraph there, why that would be the case. And then they make a hypothesis, okay, if there is a relationship, if accuracies actually are one of the determinants of whether people use government information systems or not, then we should observe a following hypothesis. So they make a hypothesis that accuracy is positively related to, correlates with intention to use e-government. So we have something, we have a causal explanation here, and then the hypothesis means what we should observe if our explanation is correct. Then we collect data and we see, okay, is there a correlation? So theory is an explanation of how, why, and when, and then we have what we should observe if the theory is correct. And this step is called a deductive step. So we have a general theory, and we go from general theory to a specific observation that should hold if the theory is correct. Then if the hypothesis does not get support from our data, then we conclude that the theory must have been a bit incorrect to start with. So theory is a very important part because it drives your research design. If you want to make a causal claim, we typically have to do that with observational studies. We don't have the luxury of doing experiments. And to do a causal claim using correlations, we must rule out the alternative explanations or alternative theories. So the theory must come before the actual data collection. Otherwise, how would we know what kind of alternative explanations we need to rule out or what kind of data do we need? The important question then is, okay, so where does the theory come from? If quantitative research is more focused on testing theory, where does the theory come from? How do we come up with new theories? How would anyone come up with the theory that women-led companies are more profitable than men-led companies? No, let's not talk about statistics. Let's just think about, CEO gender causes a company to become more profitable. So how could anyone come up with that kind of claim? Well, maybe you have been working in four companies, two of which had a great women CEO and two of which had a very bad women CEO, and then you make a claim that maybe this generalizes. Or maybe you have read something about the individual differences and how your gender influences how you process information, and then you infer that maybe these differences have an effect on the company profitability. Or maybe you were doing a qualitative study where you were looking at what do CEOs actually do in companies and then how that does influence the profitability. So what the theory comes from for quantitative research, it doesn't really matter. It could be your own intuition, it could be derived from existing theory, it could be a qualitative research that you have done before, or it could be that you just have observed that something tends to happen, and then you start to think about why. So the theory in a quantitative study is typically a hypothesis. So you make an explanation that, okay, this is how it could work, and then you explain why it would be reasonable, and then you test if it actually works that way. So that's the way quantitative research works. In qualitative research, things work a bit differently. So in quantitative research, we have the causal process. We have the causal, we have A causes B, and there is some kind of process. So women, the CEO gender influences profitability. If it does, it must do it through some kind of process. The women do something differently than men, and that doing something differently influences the company's profitability. So we have to, the theory is an explanation of what is the process behind the cause. And in qualitative research, we don't have the numbers, so we don't have the association, we don't have the directional influence or eliminate rival explanations. But let's take a look at now the quantitative research part. So when we have a cause and an effect, there must be some kind of process. So where is the causal process? Anywhere in these three? conditions. Do any of these conditions actually address what is the causal process? No. For a quantitative researcher, the causal process is a black box. So we can't look at what is the process that produced the correlation. We only see that women-led companies are more profitable than men-led companies. Why they are more profitable? Something that the women do that we don't observe. We only observe the data. And the key difference in qualitative and quantitative research is that whereas in quantitative research, we sit here in the office, someone brings us data, and then we try to think for alternative explanations. In qualitative research, the qualitative researcher actually takes five women-led companies and then takes five men-led companies and then goes and see what actually goes on. What is the difference between men-led companies and women-led companies? What do the women do differently? And then they see that, okay, the process works that way. And that's the reason why women are more better leaders. So in qualitative research, we have the luxury of actually seeing the phenomenon in action. In quantitative research, we are much more distant. So typically, theories come from qualitative research. Someone observes that there is in 10 companies, there's some kind of pattern. And then a quantitative researcher, such as I, will look at whether the pattern holds for 1,000 companies, because you can't go and interview 1,000 companies or observe. So the difference between qualitative and quantitative is, whereas in qualitative, you want to learn about and observe what goes on in the phenomena that you study. In quantitative, we take a much more hands-off approach. We have to think what are the things that we observe, and we kind of like, we poke the process that we're interested in from distance, but we never go in hands-on. Therefore, we can't really explain. We can only say that there is or is not a relationship. Questions and discussions this far. So the important parts are that we use p-values to rule out chances and explanations. If the p-value is low, small, then we infer that there must be an association or a difference. That's not exactly a valid inference, but that's what we do. Then we have, if to make a causal claim, which we typically do, we have to think about the direction of influence. Is it the cause, not the other way around? The companies become more profitable after hiring women CEO, not that they hire women CEOs after they become more profitable. Then we have to think of alternative explanations and how we rule them out. We can do that alternative explanations by either experiments, which in most cases are not feasible. But we have some master theses that do quantitative studies with experiments. For example, I guided two studies that were focusing on computer games. And they did an experiment of turning some of the game features on and off randomly and then comparing whether that influenced the satisfaction that the people got from the games. So that's a randomized controlled experiment. Then the other strategy was statistical controls. Let's, at the end of the lecture, talk a bit about what makes qualitative research or research more generally valuable. We have the two concepts of reliability and validity. So those are the two qualities of high-quality research. Research must be reliable, and it must be valid. The difference between reliability and validity is that reliability basically means if we were to repeat the study again using the same procedures, would we get the same result? So it means that the study is reproducible. If we get the result and then we repeat the study 10 more times and we never get the same result anymore, then we conclude that the original study wasn't very, very reliable. So we can have these chance findings. So that's reliability is about whether chance could have influenced the result. Then validity means whether the study actually prov- provides an answer to the research question behind the study and whether that answer is correct. This is a very commonly used example. It's from the Singleton and Straits book, among others. So reliability and validity are like precision. So is this reliability or is this validity? So these are targets, and somebody is shooting at the targets. And this guy will always hit approximately the same target. So we'll get always the same result, but he doesn't hit the bullseye. So the result is incorrect. This guy hits all over the target, so it's unreliable, but on average, he hits the bullseye, so it's valid. And which do you think is more problematic? Unreliability or invalidity? If these were actual targets and someone was actually shooting, which target would you choose to stand in front of? Yeah. If your results are invalid, then they can't inform policy at all. So invalid results are worthless. Unreliable results on the other hand, if you repeat unreliable study many, many times, on average, the study produces the correct answer. And it's much more dangerous to be here. This is actually useful, and this is not. So validity can also, the validity then is divided into different subcategories. But the most important difference is to understand that reliability is about whether the study produces the same result over and over. It doesn't say anything about whether the result is correct or not. For example, if let's take an example of intelligence measurement. If I would measure the circumference of your head with a measuring tape, that would be a highly reliable measure of intelligence because I get the same result because the size of your head doesn't change. But it's an invalid measure because it doesn't really measure what we say it what we want to measure. On the other hand, we can have unreliable measurement, unreliable study. For example, if we have a child that wiggles, we put the child on a scale, the scale shows a different result every time we weigh the child, but on average, it shows the correct result. So it answers the question, it just answers it in an imprecise way. Reliability and validity in quantitative research are pretty well-defined concepts. So reliability is basically related to your data collection, because after data collection, you are using computer to process your data, and computers are completely deterministic. There is no randomness involved. So the only reason why you would get a different result is that you have different data. So it's about reliability. Will you get the same result if you measure, collect the same data again? Then we have measurement validity. So validity is four different things. Measurement validity, do you actually measure what you're intended to measuring? For example, if we ask you whether you're satisfied on the course from 1 to 5, does that actually measure course satisfaction? It probably does. In some other cases, just asking people's opinions is not a very good measure. Then we have statistical conclusion validity. That basically refers to whether we identify the correlations correctly. We don't do type 1 errors where we say that there's a correlation where in fact there is not. And it means that we don't have type 2 error where we say that there is no correlation where in fact there is. Internal validity refers to whether our causal claims are correct. So have we identified the right set of alternative explanations and control for them appropriately? And then external validity refers to whether the study generalizes to other settings. So if somebody is doing the study in a completely different setting, would they have the same result? If we make a study about the Finnish companies and whether their CEOs are men or women, does it generalize to Swedish companies? Does it generalize to Russian companies? So that's the question of external validity, to how far the study generalizes after we have established all these things. Typically, this is interpreted as a hierarchy. So if you don't have reliability, then it's very difficult to argue any of these. If your data don't really capture the phenomena of interest, then you don't have measurement validity. You really can't do any of this other thing. If your statistics are incorrect, then you really can't make any causal claims and so on. So this is about statistical inference ruling out the alternative ruling out chance, and this is causal inference ruling out alternative explanations. Then when we do research, these are defined in the research process. In quantitative research, the process typically looks like that. So you start with a topic, and then based on the topic, you think some kind of research question that you want to answer, and then you design what data do I need, which variables, which cases. So if we study the effect of CEO gender on profitability, we are, of course, interested in the CEO gender, we're interested in the profitability. What other things do we need to collect? And company size, industry, what are the columns in our data sheet? Then we need to decide which companies are we looking at? What are the rows in our Excel sheet that contains the data? So that's about measures and sampling. Then we go and we collect the data, we do some processing to the data, do some calculations and report. The quality of a statistical study or quantitative study is typically defined here. So if you have bad data, then you can't really fix that by using fancy analysis techniques. But if you have really great data, then even some of the most simple things like a correlation could do the job. So the quality of the research question and quality of the data dictates if your study is worth something or not. Then we have four main designs that we can use to do quantitative research. Of course, we can do a combination of these. But the main designs are a laboratory experiment. We collect people into lab. We divide them into control group and treatment group. Control group does one task. Treatment group does another task. Then we compare the results. That's the medical research example. One group takes pill in lab. Another one takes a placebo in lab. We check what's the outcome. The next one is a survey where our data comes from asking people's opinions. So we ask whether you want to do well on this course, and then we ask whether you enjoy the course, and then we take a correlation, then we try to make a causal claim that enjoying the course is related to doing well, for example. Then we have field research, which means that instead of asking people's opinions, we collect data through observations. For example, we could observe here in the class of how many of you are using a computer, and then we could observe your test scores and correlate. So we're not asking people anything, we're observing data. So that's field research. And then archival research is something that we go to an existing database. For example, we could for this course, we could take the average grade that you get over the years, and then correlate it with the presence of certain instructors or correlate with class size or whatever data we have. So that's using data that somebody else has collected. And of course, you can combine this. Yeah. So we are running out of time, so I had these slides, examples of research design, just in case we have time, but typically we don't. So we could take some questions now, and questions about the content of this course and this lecture, and then I will tell you what you should do for the next lecture.
Are you going to put these slides on the optimum?
They are there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I typically put the slides right before the lecture starts, because I reviewed them the day before, and then I may do some changes, but they're going to be about the same as last year. So small changes, but they are there. And all the other slides are there as well. I may update them a bit. It's not in Optima. Send me an email about it, and I'll check it. So I'll check it right away when I get back to my computer. Then for the next class, I want you to read the chapter by Singleton and Straits on measurement, because we are going to be talking about how do we actually get the data that we analyze. and then skim through the Venkatesh paper. We're going to be talking about how this particular paper applied the measurement principles that our singleton and straits talk about. The key things of that you should remember from these classes is that the challenge in doing quantitative research is that we take observations, we take samples, and we want to generalize from that sample to some kind of population. So that's the part about statistical inference. Can we say that there really is a correlation? We have a correlation in the sample. It could be by chance only, and we want to rule out chance as an explanation. So generalizing from sample to a population is what we call statistical inference. Then we have three conditions of causality. First, we have to have the association. Then we have to show the direction of effect. It's the cause before the effect. And then that's easy. You just measure the cause before the effect. And then we have the hard part, which is elimination of rival explanations. So we have to think in advance what other reasons there could be for the correlation of interest. Then association must not be because of chance only or because of alternative causes. We have two strategies to eliminate rival hypotheses. Experiment, we randomize people, and then one gets the treatment, other one doesn't. Then we measure the result, and statistical controls. And quality of the study is determined by reliability and validity, which can be subdivided into these four categories presented on the slide. Okay, if there are no questions, then I'll let you go, and I'll stay here for a few minutes if you want to ask something in private. I'll be posting the slides and the video when I get back to my computer.